The Rabbis Podcast is powered by Coachella Media. Go to www.coachellamedia.com for all your digital marketing needs.
This is the Rabbis Podcast.
It's geschmack to be a hit.
Hello to everybody out there. This is Rabbi Pinchas Landis, a Partners in Torah of Cleveland, and I am here with my co-host, Rabbi Gamliel Nussan Halevi Spiro of Yeshivas Office of Torah of Cleveland, and we are the Rabbis Podcast, which you can now find at the Jewish Podcasting Network at JewCast.com. We've been talking about it for weeks. The network has been launched, JewCast, seven letters, JewCast.com. That's where you can now find all of our podcasts, as well as many other wonderful Jewish podcasts. And we are back here today to bring you another episode of the Rabbis Podcast. And
Relance, this is, well, I want to interrupt for 1 second.
You're interrupting me?
I don't want to be called your co-host. I want to be called your cohort.
Do we do the introduction again?
No, but I'm saying my cohort. I prefer to be called a cohort. I'm not even sure what that word means.
It doesn't mean co-host.
I want to be called your cohort, if you don't mind. Maybe we don't have to do the introduction again. We'll next week we'll get it right.
Yeah, cohort means a group of people, but okay, that's fine. But you anyhow, know what it means? Cohort is a group of people. Like a cohort is a cohort of people. So, but you can be my cohort. That's fine. If it works for you. Anyhow, but we have to, first of all, or second of all, or maybe up to third of all already, wish Rabbi Spiro a Mazel Tov, because Rabbi Spiro just became a Zayda this past week for the fourth time. The guy is a Zaydi four times over before the age of 50. Kanan Ahara, Baruch Hashem, Simchas in Klal Yisrael. And it's very exciting. This is Reuven Yosef had a baby in Muncie, New York,
with his.
You know, I have to say, I'm a little actually offended, because you just told this to me today, and the baby was born on Sunday night. And not only that, but the Fetter spoke at the Pitch Shmorg this week, and his wife was there. The Tanta and the Fetter were both there, and neither of them said, "You have a new." I don't know what's it if your cohorts. If your cohort's kid has a baby, what is that kid to you?
A great nephew or nothing?
I don't know. It reminds me of one of the great scenes in cinema history when Dark Helmet took on Lone Star in Spaceballs, and he said, "Something you have to know before we go on with this. I am your father's cousin, sister's uncle's former roommate. What does that make us? Absolutely nothing. I just thought we should go on. You need to know that before we go on." Anyhow, so bottom line, that's a big mazel tov on that, and I'm offended. I'm offended that Rabbi Kovel did not tell me, Yosef Kovel did not tell me, Mrs. Kovel didn't tell me, you didn't tell me. Like, I don't rank over here. That's the bottom line. I know, you know, it's good for my humility. It's kind of like when those Navardikers used to go into the hardware store and ask for salami sandwiches. You know, I know where I rank.
Never be offended. First of all, I'll tell you the truth. It happened Sunday night, and it's been so busy with so. First of all, obviously I'm very busy with Yeshiva Baruch Hashem, and more than that, and the Daily Navi podcast,
which is available on JewCast.com.
We've become one. You know those nerds who are like constantly promoting themselves. Am I going to become one of those nerds now?
Very severe. I think you might already.
I'm already be a nerd.
Yeah.
And then also, I don't even know a bunny pushed. Should we go in for the Shalom Zachar? Not going for the Shalom Zachar. The Bris is Monday, Mirz Hashem.
Mm-hmm. By the way, everybody in the tri-state area, all our fans out there are invited to the Bris in Muncie, New York. Actually, no, because you have to feed them. Maybe not.
You can't invite to a Bris. You can announce.
I meant to announce, of course. It's in Muncie, New York, at some place.
It's at, I don't even know. It's
someplace. Check out with Rabbi Spiro. Dial him on his portable rotary phone, and he'll tell you.
Be happy for anyone to come to the Bris.
Very exciting, Rabbi Spiro. Very excited for you and the Rebbetzin, for Reuven Yosef, for his wife. It's beautiful. Simchas and Klal Yisrael and Kein Yerbo. Just continue. And the Fetter, the Mechutin Fetter, your Mechutin Fetter, whatever you want to call him, he did a beautiful job at the Shmorg this week. It was great.
Oh, Yosef Kovel. Yeah, Kovel's the man.
Yeah, Yosef is a good man. We should give him a podcast
friends,
one of these
you
days.
You know, we're friends from where we were kids. I used to come to Cleveland to visit my grandmother, mm-hmm. my grandparents. Yosef Kovel lived right next door. We were buddies. Severn Road.
Yeah, he's a good man, Yosef Kovel.
He still lives on Severn Road.
Well, that's what they call it now, Rehov Kovel, because all Kovels, whole Kovel family, except for Srili and Ruchi, who are over here.
His father lived right next door to, I'm trying to remember, Artudas, hell yeah, for my grandparents.
Because Murray Zozangazun is there, and Jake Zozangazun is there, and I think that someone else is there too, right? And Yoel and Hoover there.
Larry Koval lives there.
Yeah, they're all there.
Fred.
Yeah.
Bernard. And I want to tell
and over LaShonda Koval.
A beautiful Gemara I saw about being Makbid. I was learning Gemara Masechta Saita. Beautiful Gemara. Daf Mem, worth repeating. Rabbi Avo. Rabbi Avo was a great Anav, very humble person. And Rabbi Avo, he would give shir in the yeshiva. Give shir, and he was the Rosh Yeshiva. And he had a meturgam, and a meturgam would be there by the shir, by the lecture, and he would translate. He would help explain. Today in yeshivas, there's something called a chayzer. After the shir, a bachur, older bachur who gets it well, would reviews it. This is somewhat similar to an idea, but more of a formal position. In any case, the meturgam's wife came over to Rabbi Avo's wife and said, "You know, you think your husband is all that. My husband, who is the meturgam, he really could be saying the top shir."
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, she thinks she'd heard from her husband. And, you know, you shouldn't be so proud of your husband. So Rabbi Avo's wife felt bad. She told him the conversation. Rabbi Avo said to his wife, he said, "Well, what difference does it make?" He said, and obviously, he had been saying this over the meturgam, and now it is an undermining thing to say. And Rabbi Avo was a Rosh Yeshiva. And he definitely had the right to dismiss the meturgam.
Mm-hmm.
And what was his response? He told his wife, he said, "What difference does it make in the end?" He goes, "In the end of the day, the Hashem's Torah is being taught, right? People attend the lecture. Who cares? Who has the more original ideas? You know, obviously the person giving the lecture, the Rosh Yeshiva, was usually more of an originator, and the meturgam would be someone who understood it well, but not necessarily as original of a thinker." Rabbi Avo was not insulted. He didn't, and that is the best way to be, never to be makbid.
You know, and I'll tell you a great idea that Rabbi Chatzkel Freundlich, who I was with for the Yom HaNoraim in Montreal, good friend of mine from many, many, many years. So this was actually is very, very, very cute how he did it. His theme for one of his drushes in Rosh Hashanah was speaking about the word meh. Now, meh is actually an official word. It's listed in the Webster's Dictionary. It originated in a Simpsons episode, apparently. I know this from the drush and not from anything else. But meh is like, I don't care, meh, right? And he was saying how, as Yidden, we can't just say meh, you know, that when someone either goes through a simcha or goes through a tzara or whatever it is. No, there are brothers, there are sisters, and even beyond that, you know, mankind in general, like, we can't take the attitude of, who cares? No, if there's someone suffering, there's someone enjoying, there's someone happy, you care. That's what it means to be a Jew. You have to care. You have to show up. You have to think about other people. And then on Yom Kippur, he took the other side. He said, "I want to ask Mechila for the word meh, from how I treated it on Rosh Hashanah. Because there is a very good use for the word meh." And it's exactly what Rabbi Spear was saying. That in that time when you feel slighted, you know, what should your response be? Meh, not a big deal. So I was slighted. So I didn't get an invitation to the wedding. So they put me at a bad table. So Rabbi Spiro and Rabbi Koval did not tell me about the new child being born. But meh, okay, you know
what? It's funny because the word meh also in Hebrew means something very similar. We say meh anu mechayenu.
Right. It's like,
what are we? Yeah. But in that way, the word meh is explicitly meant as also as a self diminishment.
Yeah, interesting. I never thought about that before. So back to that's you know, as I often refer to them, the great theologians of our generation, the Simpsons.
I used to think I was a self hating Jew, then I realized I'm just an anti-Semite.
Rabbi Spiro is quoting one of my favorite clips from The Simpsons when Krusty the Clown thought that he was no longer Jewish. That was his response. And by the way, I know we don't make political comments here on the show, but I recently, if you look at my Twitter feed, which I also don't make political comments really with that much, but I did post that video and say, the moment when Bernie Sanders finds out he's not really a Jew. Yeah, anyhow, on to the next subject for today. Rabbi Spear, what else is happening? We got so much flying over here. It's just, you know, a lot of good stuff. A lot of you know, just crazy, wacky, wild stuff in the world.
So we're getting into the winter today. It started snowing in Cleveland. Every year,
second snow already. We had snow last week.
Sorry, we had a little bit of snow last week, but we're getting this week's parsha. Lech Lecha.
It's the beginning of the
beginning. Officially we're doing Navi now, but it's you know, these parashios of the year, these Torah portions that we do in Sefer Bereishis, it's just amazing. You could learn them. I've learned parashas Lech Lecha, including from when I was a kid, right? Every year since I was 6 years old.
Right, you learned it 40.
Obviously, then 40, on a very basic 40, level. Yeah. I'm 47 now. And it's just amazing the depth of these words of Hashem, that every year we find something new, we find something different. So
right, and it goes back to the, as Landis often quotes or talks about, the idea of, as Jews, we cannot be plagued with lullaby syndrome.
Right.
That you got to ask the questions, and especially when we start new. Like I realize, and when you do this, you realize things. We dealt with this a little bit last week, talking about through the Yom Nuraim, the davening again. At you know me at 41 years old, so I've been through the Yom Nuraim davening at least as an adult 25 times, or at least a Kanya, you know, someone who's paying somewhat attention 25 plus times. But I stop. Oh, look, that's interesting. Oh, what's that doing there? And that's how you're supposed to look at the Sidra. That's why there's a chiyuv, I guess mitzvah derabanan, if you will. Well, not really mitzvah derabanan, but
exactly.
So, yeah, an obligation of what's called a shtay mikra v'chatargum, that a person has an obligation to review the parsha every week and do to read it at least twice and to use a targum at least once. And there's a whole kind of, you know, a bunch of different opinions on what could be kind of a targum. You know, but I would say if you're fluent in Hebrew, you know, you should be reading it twice and doing at least Rashi, probably Unklus too. And if you're not fluent, you know what? Make sure you read the English. But the idea is that you got to go through the parsha every week, and there's so much there, and ask those questions. Just last week, I had something that popped up that I thought was interesting that connects the end of last week's parsha, the segue into this week's parsha. But it's, I guess, a little bit of a question. I have to look back in the Chumash and see if it's true, but who was the first person to ever name for his father? Which is a very, very common custom. If you were a Sephardi, I assume this baby's name was going to be Gamliel Nassim, but you're Ashkenazi. By the way, you know why Ashkenazim do not name for living relatives?
Ein hara, I thought.
No. No, it's I forgot where I saw this shtetl, but it's a pagam, a possible nichshon kivadav, because let's say hypothetically Reuven Yosef would name his kid Gamliel Nassan. So technically you're not halachically within the halachos of honoring your parents and kivadav aim, you cannot obviously refer to your parent by the first name, but you're also really not supposed to refer to anybody by your parent's first name. People don't realize that. It's a little complicated to follow, but like my father's name, you know, if I would meet someone else on that name, I'm not supposed to refer to them with that name either. So the idea is that if Reuven Yosef would name his kid Gamliel Nassan and say, hey, Gami, come over here, or... but it could be
know the Avos were Ashkenazim and not Sephardim?
They didn't name after
Then it would be Avram, Yitzhak, and Avram.
I like that. Look at that. There you go. There you have it. Anyways, but we do see the example of what I think is the first time someone names for his father. And who is it? It's Terach. What was Terach's father's name?
Oh, Nachor.
Nachor. What was Terach's son's name? Nachor. I think it's the first time it happened. I never thought about that before. Because you definitely see it. It is fascinating that the concept of Kiyum Hashem, of naming for someone and keeping the name alive,
is not mentioned anywhere,
but you don't even really see it until the we'll call it the House of Hillel, right? With all the Shimon Ben Gamliel, Gamliel, Gamliel. That's really the first time you see it in history.
First time we ever see it.
And you don't really see it at all before, except for these like rare exceptions, like we mentioned a couple of times. I see you find a few Yishmaels. You will find people
but
named.
You find in Navi also. You don't almost find no one in Navi
named Avraham,
named Avraham,
Moshe,
named Yitzchak, named Yaakov.
Yeah. So now, again, a few exceptions.
Like, there are exceptions, and it's always hard to know in Navi. Sometimes a person's name in Navi is not their given name; it's the name they've earned.
Right. That's because of all Divrei Yamim. When you learn Divrei Yamim, this comes up. You know, all
right,
the time.
Boaz, right? The famous Boaz.
Yiv's son is Boaz. Moshe. Right. Moshe has many names.
And Moshe's given name was not Moshe.
Right.
I've seen a few different opinions. I saw an opinion. His given name was Avigdor.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a given name. His name was Yekusiel. I've seen, right. But no one says. Everyone agrees it was.
But no one says it's Jared. Abbasia. Jared's my favorite name in Moshe.
Jared.
Jared's a Jewish name. People don't realize.
I don't like the name Jared.
No, but it's one of Moshe Rabbeinu's names. Yared.
Yared. But Yared. Not Jared.
It's Jared in English.
Jared,
come on.
But it's not a good name. I like Jerry's a good name, but not Jared.
What about Jay? We won't talk about that. Anyhow, so that's you know, that's but so this concept of it really it's like 2,000 years old. It's not. It doesn't. It, you know, like Rabbi Spiro said, you have very rare exceptions, but for the most part, you don't find even up until really the Tanayim. The Tanayim are new names. They're not named for right. Except for Rabbi Shmuel. Again, it's interesting, but you have Shmuel. You have.
I don't know if I agree with your thesis that the people named Rabbi Shmuel. The Kohen Gadol and the Tana. I'm not sure if they're named after the famous Yishmael
Ben Netanyahu. Well, bottom line is...
I'm not sure if they're named after...
Well, I go more the other direction, that for sure after the rise of Islam, you won't find anyone named, any Jew named Yishmael. That's for sure.
Right.
That's for sure. You will find Jews named Nimrod, which is a whole different story. But
that's just past 30 years, probably.
Past 40 years. I'd say probably past 70 years since with modern Hebrew. That's from the rise of modern Hebrew because.
I think in Israel, the name of Nimrod it became a popular name. I was a bacher in Eretz Yisrael. People were like talking about, "Wow, the Israelis are naming their kids Nimrod."
It's crazy. And where did it come from? Because even in secular Israeli schools, which are not by any stretch of the imagination Jewish schools. My understanding of this, I'm not exactly sure if my historical facts are solid on this, but I think that while Ben-Gurion was totally secular and was a socialist and was not religious and not at all, I mean, like he wanted to have cabinet meetings on Yom Kippur. I mean, really not religious, but he was like a biblical scholar. He felt that the study of Bible as a scholarly book was important. And therefore, I don't know if it's still the case, but it was often part of the public school curriculum in Israel. The non-religious public school curriculum was Bible study. So if you just look in last week's Parsha, don't say anything bad about Nimrod. It's the only time it's mentioned in Chumash by name. I mean, again, we're going to have him by the Mochama, by one of his other names, which one was he? He was Amraphel. But the only time he's mentioned is last week's Parsha. It says he was a Gibor Chayil. He was a strong, and that's it. So if you look at the Chumash, he's nothing wrong with him. Great guy, right? So if you're just learning Peshuta Shel Mikra, so to speak, then okay, nothing's wrong with
the name Nimrod. That's not why they named him.
You don't think that's where it came from?
Absolutely.
That's where did it come from?
I remember when it was started being done.
So where did it come from?
It became the specific idea of because the name, what does name Nimrod means?
Nimrod.
The rebellious one.
Right, the Nimrod, the idiot, right.
No, but the one who rebelled against Hashem.
Okay, so you think it's really like you think it was the Dafka?
I don't think it. I know it. I'm telling you, I remember when I was in Eretz Yisrael in the 90s, the name was coming into vogue, and people were even talking about it as such, that this is
really?
The popular name.
I don't
name.
Know, maybe I'm down the cuffs close people too much.
I remember. The name Nimrod means the one, it literally means the one who rebelled. Right? That's right. The meaning of Nimrod. Israelis know that. The word Nimrod means in America is the word of a Nimrod. It's not like that in Israel.
Yeah,
there's no Nimrod means a fool. It doesn't mean that in Israel. Nimrod means the rebellious one. So why would Israelis give her kid a name, the rebellious one?
Okay, we'll put a research committee on it.
That was a lot of the culture milieu of the secular Zionists, that they are new Jews. They're rebelling against the old ways.
I understand that, but to name your we're the new Jews. We're gonna name our kids Hitler. You know, like that's what it's doing. You know, I don't know.
I don't know if they relate to it. First of all, I don't think they relate to him in such a negative way. They relate to him as a person who rebelled against the contemporary mores of the world.
Establishment. Yeah, okay. Could be. Anyhow, so that's so but it is like you said, the idea of naming is a fairly, you know, 2 millennium phenomenon. But now it's like the thing. Like who's he named for? It's become such a thing, right? And it's just so much so that you have these funny names like the name Schneer. Right? So where did Schneer come from? Schneer, people think that's a Yiddish name. It's not a Yiddish name.
You say it from Schneor?
Schneor, because it's someone who's named for a Meir and a Yair, a Meir and a Yair.
Such a famous name, Schneor.
Some famous people had the name, Schneor Cutler.
So my name is Gamil Nelson. I've named this for my great-grandfather.
You told me this before.
Right, the custom of the city was, he was born on the day of the Nisim, the beginning of Chodesh Nisan, and that day his Nasi was Gamil ben Pedatzur. I've never heard of such a minhag before. And shouldn't he be more like Achiezer, with names like that running around, but there's not. But that's why I do prefer Nelson over Gamil. Gamil's an interesting name. I don't know about it. I'm fine with either name. My point is, though,
people think you're a Kabbalist if you want to know that name.
Oh, Gamil Rabinovich.
Gamil Rabinovich, yeah.
But you see, one of my kids has a Yiddish name, but we gave it to them as a second name.
Right.
Right, so there wouldn't be.
So that's the other interesting thing, the whole, and look, we both have it. We have kids. The origin of the two-name Jewish name, also, where did that come from? That's only European. Sephardim, I don't know, maybe now Sephardim have it, but it's only Europeans, only Ashkenazim. And it was not pshat that they gave their kids two names. It's they had their Hebrew name and they had their Yiddish name. And that's why, comes to mind, my brother-in-law's father, Rabbi Gershenfeld, right? So he goes by Beryl Gershenfeld, but he's called to the Torah as Dov Ber, whatever it is. And, Herschel Schachter is called up to the Torah Tzvi Schachter, because that's what it was. It's like me. I'm Pinchas Landis, and Pierce is my English name, so I would have been Pinchas Pierce, right? That's where the name came from. So the whole concept of having two names wasn't trying to name for two people or combine two things. It was all Dov Ber. Tzvi Hirsch. It was all the Hebrew and the Yiddish.
But there were people who had two Hebrew names.
Were there?
I think so.
Give me an example before you had two Yiddish names. So my understanding is having two names was simply that
Nassen
it was...
Nassen Tzvi. Rabbi Alter Sabatka's name was Nassen Tzvi. The two Hebrew names.
Okay, so but that's you're not going back that far. You're not going back that far. I'm saying going. This probably started. I don't know. You're going by let's say 400 or 500 years probably when this started. But that's what it was.
That's where it came from.
And that's why some of these names like my name Pinchas Leib. I have Leib is Hebrew. I'm sorry, Leib is Yiddish. People think it's Leib. It's not. It's Leib, a lion, lion cub. It's a family name, but it's incongruent. But so names are, we go on and on with names. Right. It's definitely a fascinating topic in of itself. But So Parshas Lech Lecha. So there's so much going on over there. You know, I have something that was interesting that's always kind of, baffled me, bothered me, rubbed me the wrong way, but it's I'll just throw this out to pick your brain on it, and it's the concept of nefesh asher asu b'haron. By the way, I always made that mistake. The Avram's brother was Haran with a hay, and the city was Haran.
He's called both his brother. I think he's called Haran.
Oh, really? Is that why I made that mistake?
I believe so, yeah.
Is that the source of my Nimrodus? So Haran's definitely the city, and the pasuk says that when Avraham left Haran to go to ultimately to Eretz Yisrael, he took his wife Sarai, he took Lot, and he took Nefesh Asher Asu B'Haran, which we understand from Rashi, from Midrashim, from Meforshim, that at this point it was 5 years into his official task as the proto Jew. That's what I like to, not to do another aside here, but I always like to ask the question, who was the first Jew, right? So it's a hard question to answer. I think there's three correct answers to that. I think so, maybe more, but at least three correct answers. If I give that question a test and I got one of three answers, I'd mark them correct. Avraham, Yaakov, Moshe. In other words, Avraham begins the process, right? Yaakov is when it goes from being a family to Klal Yisrael. And then Moshe gets the Torah. So that's the completion of the creation of Klal Yisrael. So he was the first person to get the Torah because he got the Torah and then gave it to
Avraham. It's hard to say.
So it's Avraham is, but definitely it begins with Avraham and it's established by Moshe. That's for sure. It's that 400 year process. So, but it talks about that going through the whole historical perspective of Avraham, that Avraham becomes a monotheist. Again, different opinions. Let's say he was 52 years old, maybe younger.
40 or 48 are the three opinions.
340 or 52. Because it's the year 2000.
Yeah, but he was 40.
He was born in the year 1948.
But it never says that he was 52. The three midrashim, the lashon they used, they just count. They say from the year 2000, but the three lashonis used in Chazal are 340 and 48.
Got it. So, anyways,
people combine them.
Right.
They're not contradicting each other. Three came to some awareness. 40 became more mature, and 48
is when he smashed the idols.
Bavel happened.
Right, and he smashed the idols.
Right.
Right. So what's interesting is you have a time period of at least 20 years where Avraham is a complete monotheist. He's teaching the world about monotheism, or teaching his area at least about monotheism. According to many midrashim, he reaches half the world with his philosophies of monotheism. And that's what the Chumash is referring to as Nefesh Asher Asu B'Charan, as those are the people he's Makariv, the people that he brought over to monotheism. And by the way, HaKadosh Baruch hasn't spoken to him yet. Kosh Baruch Hu speaks to him for the first time at the Bris Bein Basarim, which is later in the Chumash, but he's... And when
the first
time
is Lech Lecha.
What's that?
First time Hashem speaks to him is Lech Lecha.
It's the second time the Chumash records. He's 75 at Lech Lecha. He's 70 at the Bris Bein Basarim. It's a concept of Ein Mutu Mechu B'Torah.
Right.
So the first time Kosh Baruch Hu speaks to him is the Bris Bein Basarim, which is essentially when Kosh Baruch Hu says to him that, okay, you've been teaching the world about me. You know, this is me, Shalom Aleichem. Now we finally meet. And by the way, if you want to sign up to be my people, here's what's going to come with it. And he gives him sort of the purview of what it means to be a Jew, what could come if the Jews stumble from their path of what they need to be a Jew. And as we understand it, Avraham saw all of world history. He saw the four Golios, the four exiles. He saw Auschwitz. He saw Khmelnytsky. He saw it all, and still signed up. So that's the first thing they communicate. So for 20 years, Avram's teaching about monotheism. 5 years after his first communication, we have Lech Lecha, where the parsha begins, and he's leaving. He's told to leave. He's told to get out for the aftermath of Migdal Babel. Again, 25 years later, the aftermath of smashing the idols, being thrown in the furnace, all these other things, and then we have these people at his makariv. That not only was he makariv, but they go with him. Question is, what happened to them? Right,
it's a famous question.
Famous question, right? And it's always bothered me. So the answer, basically, that I've always seen and been given is it didn't take. It didn't take. He was Makar of them. They became monotheists. But, you know, as things started and circumcision and it became a little bit more of a commitment, I don't didn't think, take.
But was he ever trying to bring them that they should be regular? I mean, the Gemara says in a couple places, and the Medrash says as well, that the Avos Shamras Kol Torah Kula, the Avos kept the entire Torah.
Right.
Did Avram ever have a Havamina? Did he ever have a thought that he wanted to bring all these nefashos, all these souls that he had made, him and Sarah? Was there ever a thought that he'd want them to do tefillin, tzitzis, bris milah?
Okay, so let's lahaniach your question. Let's say you're right. Okay, still, where are they? In other words, if Avram had reached masses of people, like the Midrashim seem to be fairly clear about, then that means that I don't know that would have been the end of polytheism in the world, but it should have been that there was a stronger monotheistic presence in the world from that point on, and there
right,
was not.
See, there was not, right. Not
so let's say like you, and not until Christianity is monotheism really brought to the, again, they're in very, very imperfect monotheism, but...
So some of Farshim say that when they Yitzchak, whose Avodah was a step more internalized, a step deeper than Avram's, it was the Midas Hadin, mm-hmm. the judgment of Hashem, that they couldn't, it was too intense for them.
Right.
And they left.
So it's interesting, I never thought about this before, but as you mentioned, Christianity, right? Let's go there for a minute. How is it that the Roman Empire became the Holy Roman Empire? It wasn't just I got it. Got a few emperors that imposed the religion. Fine, but it bounced back and forth a lot in the beginning, right? You had Constantine, then you had
Eric?
No.
Oh, no, sorry.
You had, I'm thinking about the one where it went back to, whatever. You had some bounce back and forth before it became the state religion. But why did it take? And my understanding is that at that point, polytheism was bankrupt. You know, the people saw just weren't into it anymore. They saw that it was ridiculous. They saw that it didn't make sense. You know, there's the metaphysical, the spiritual idea behind that of what the Gemara says, or at the beginning of Bais Sheni, that the Yetzer Hara for Avodah Zarah was eradicated already, and that took a few hundred years to play out and played out in the world. So whatever it is, by the end of the Roman Empire, people aren't into polytheism anymore, and they're into monotheism. And according to many historians, that up to 10% of the Roman Empire had converted to Judaism. You have Uncles Agar. Uncles was literally the son of the emperor.
Nephew.
Sorry, the nephew of the emperor, right? He was the nephew of the emperor. That's why what happened when his uncle disowned him, he became Uncleless. Uncleless. But wait, wrong one. Sorry, we gotta get the right one. Sorry. I'm still not used to the sound effects. There we go. Got it right. That was a drum roll. But you see that Unklus was not a yachid. There was a movement, and that there was a strong interest in monotheism amongst the Roman Empire. Now, once they had an option to be monotheist without having to keep Shabbos, without having to be circumcised, without having to put on tefillin, without having to do that, that caught like wildfire.
But you do see in the world, you know, I don't remember if we discussed this last week on the podcast, but I was definitely discussing it this year somewhere. Question of
maybe it was on the Navi podcast.
Well, no. Not into there yet. About Noach and Yaina. I think we did mention it.
You didn't talk about Noach and Yaina.
Noach was meant to spread a message, and he was not successful.
Right.
Right. He got, and in fact, he had no followers.
Right. He was the first unsuccessful Kiruv organization.
His wife, his three children, and their spouses.
Right. And he had 120 years to do it.
Right. However,
that's a
Yonah came to the city of Ashur.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He went to Nineveh, which was in the kingdom of Ashur. Yeah. A huge city, mm-hmm. right? A major metropolis. And it seems he obviously
was successful.
He was
right.
he definitely, I don't know if the entire city, but a good
the way it's told to us, and which by the way is the reason why Yonah didn't want to go in the first place. At least
right.
according
so
to, you know.
I've heard the answer given that Yonah, that it was Hashem kind of nudged the Nineveh in the direction because he wanted it to be a limud for Klal Yisrael.
Which is why Yonah didn't want to go because he didn't want it to be an indictment on Klal Yisrael.
But so how do we get that certain times you'll have a movement will come? Why do certain charismatic people, you know, you can ask this question in history. Hitler was a person of great charisma, obviously.
Yeah, for sure.
And he made a whole movement, as did not so much Karl Marx. Karl Marx was a machadish idea, but you can
Lenin, Stalin
made this idea. But then you also have other crazy people who never really took off.
David Koresh. Really took off.
David Koresh. How many people did he have there?
I don't know, a few hundred. 40, 50 people. That was like 100. A little more than that.
With that guy Jones in Guyana, Jonestown.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and the
grape Kool-Aid, right? How many
was that? The Haley Boppers? That's a different one. A
couple hundred people,
and the Haley Boppers. Don't forget Haley Bopper, whatever. The guys are the people are going to go up to the kingdom of heaven on the Haley's comment.
So you wonder why? So it has to do with probably personality. Obviously, the personality to a certain extent. Probably some of it's the message they're giving. I think Hitler was able to tap into the psyche of Amalek, of the German people, very well, and he was able.
Yeah, in a lot of his circumstances, he was able to. It was the German economy had been destroyed after war and wasn't rebounding. And the Weimar Republic wasn't doing a good job.
When Hashem gives the it's all these different things come. I mean, obviously, it's all based on Tiat HaShemayah, when Hashem allows these things to happen. But just it's interesting. So I don't know. So these people could be after Avram. Maybe Yitzhak felt it wasn't his tafkid anymore.
I think, as I started to say before, I think the answer might be in part the same thing we saw with the rise of Christianity, that as this became a thing, a religion, you're right, so the Elvis kept Kol HaTorah Kula. That was, we understand that because the Torah is the instruction book for the world, and if you are, which Rabbi Spiro is in his spare time, a mechanical engineer, you don't necessarily need a manual to tell how to work something. We had our heat went out last week, and Shimon Schlesinger, who, by the way, I highly recommend if anyone needs any HVAC work, I forget the name of his company, but he came over and he takes one look, he knows right away what's wrong, and me, I did open the thing up, but I was like, I don't know what this is. He didn't need any manuals, right? So Avraham Avinu was so spiritually in depth. It had such a spiritual depth that he was able to look at the world and understand the instruction book to the world. That's the Torah. So whether he was transmitting that to his students or whether it was just that Avram was given mitzvahs, he was given bris milah for sure, right? There were certain things that were coming, the fire got too hot, so to speak, it could be. So it's like the reverse of what you see in the Roman Empire, that they wanted it, but like until there was a recipe to be able to do it without the fire's being so hot, so to speak, it just didn't take. So I think that's the truth is probably somewhere around there.
You wonder if the psyche of the American people would ever be able to follow a leader like that who would lead them into
a religious revolution,
a different place, either oblivion or religious revolution or anything. I don't know if it's in American people's psyche. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like nowadays, I'm just not even America. Just like nowadays, in the sort of the post-imperialistic world, that worked in the imperialistic world, which arguably lasted from Nimrod to Hitler. You know, the imperialistic world lasted 3,000 years.
But I'll tell you something I heard from Avolbi, Shem Avolbi. He was a great mashgiach in Israel, who was Nifter, I don't know, probably 10 years ago, something like that. So Avolbi said, after the Six-Day War, right, Israel was riding on a tremendous high. It was a great victory.
Right.
And unfortunately, they did not see Hashem's hand in the victory enough, the country of Israel. And there was a strong feeling of Kaychi Vaitim Yadi, right? My strength did this for me, which is not the way a Jew is supposed to look at things. And this led to the Yom Kippur War. If you look historically, 6 years later, the Yom Kippur War, Israel was totally unprepared. And if you read the history, they should not have been totally unprepared. There was many, many warning signals, which Golda Meir resigned after the Yom Kippur War. Because she missed so many obvious signals of what was happening. And Israel fell into a... The state,
she did resign, but labor stayed in power a little bit longer. That's what
she did. The state fell into something of a depression.
Mm-hmm.
not an economic, but an emotional one. A lot of loss of life, and they were so unprepared, and it was just a shock for them. So the Ar Sameach was just starting, and not only Ar Sameach for America, Ar Sameach for Americans had started a few years before. Right. I forgot what it was called.
Shema Yisrael.
It was a combination of
Shema Yisrael. That's like Noach Weinberg. I think we talked about this before, but it's so amazing. I think he started to try the yeshiva before Eshet Torah. He had like five false starts. Right. It's amazing. Just talking about the.
But they also made an Israeli Ar Sameach,
mm-hmm.
which was being extremely successful, and they were having talks being given. You have to ask if Nata Schiller knows the story. And Armando Weinbach, not allowed anywhere. They knew the story. They were having people go onto military bases, and it was really being successful.
Yeah, that was the beginning of the Kirov movement.
But then Revolbi said, he said, what killed it? He said, the Israeli media. That the Israeli media took on, all of a sudden they were seeing this Truva revolution starting to sprout, and the media made it a particular goal of theirs to quash this movement, mm-hmm. and they did.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And Ervolbi used to say, he said, you know, Ervolbi was very, he loved Jews, and he was very, not a negative person. He said, but the Israeli media are Rishayim. I was repeating him easy.
Well, I think you can drop Israeli from that. I think most media is Rishayim, but
it's,
yeah,
it's
for sure.
The idea of, and he said that they killed this Tshuva revolution, which was fermenting and was really ready to burst out, and they totally killed it.
Yeah.
Media is a very not Jewish concept, right? The whole idea.
Although it's always been controlled by the Jews.
It's just like the banks,
yep.
Right? The whole idea of having a set news time to report without even there being necessarily news,
right,
creates the need of filling that vacuum and creating news. And as your big chassid, you're a big chassid of Donald Trump, as he always says,
do not
fake
say that
news
on this show.
I'm just kidding. Let's
try that. I might have to erase that from Spiro. I don't want that to
we're just,
even,
that was
even
a joke. That was a joke. I was making
that
fun
was
of
a joke.
We are not chassidim of Donald Trump.
No, not on this show.
We are impartial. We try not to involve ourselves in politics, but we do. It is true. The media is a negative in the world. And the whole idea, it's interesting. The media has created this thing. When I was in Eretz Yisrael, during one of the terrorist tragedies, there's always been a known thing in Israel, and the media did respect this. You don't report a death, whether militarily or a terrorist attack. You don't report it until the family's informed first.
Right.
And that was always respected by all the media in Israel.
Right.
And someone broke it during one of the terrorist attacks when I was there. They confronted someone at their door. They didn't know their child had been killed.
Mm.
And people said to them, people were very angry. Other media, right, everyone was angry at them. How could you break this unwritten code? He said, the public has a right to know. That was the answer he gave.
I hate that response.
There's no, and that's a very, there's no such thing as that.
Yeah.
What does it mean?
I had this debate once here in Cleveland with, he's a friend of mine, but Kevin Adelstein, who owns the Cleveland Jewish News. And there was a certain topic we were talking about, a certain.
You want me to do a run by fruiting to his house?
No, because I like him. He's a good guy. And look, you know, it's whatever. I get it, it's their business. But there's a certain thing that had happened within the Jewish world, a certain person who was caught in an embarrassing situation, and the press blew it up into being a lot worse than it should have been, and I was talking to him about it. I was
very embarrassed.
It was not Rabbi Spiro, this particular situation, I felt that the person, for a number of different reasons, was being treated so unfairly by the press, and I felt this Jewish community were for sure better than that, but this was the general press. This was a Jewish person, but in the general press, and he said, no, I think people have a right to know what happens. I said, I don't agree with you. I just said, why?
It's a very funny concept of public.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, with the flip side of that is you live in a totalitarian regime. Which,
right.
So obviously, there, like everything in life, there has to be a degree of seichel. The Rambam calls, right, the Derech HaMamutza, the Shvil Azav, the Golden Path, the Middle Road. There obviously has to, there's a difference between public having a right to know and totalitarianism. There,
yeah,
is something 100%. In between there.
Yeah. And look, we all know the big example of this is in understanding sort of the first time that the negative inverse of this hit the world was the Vietnam War. That the Vietnam War was the first televised war, and yet it was a debacle. Any way you cut it, it was a debacle, but all the negative pushback you had with soldiers being spat upon and all that stuff, that was partially because not only was it a debacle, it was a televised debacle.
Right. One of the generals said, he said, Walter Cronkite came out against the war one night during his nightly news report, which is not his job, but he came. And one of the generals said, we're finished now, because Cronkite was the news.
Right.
And he said, Cronkite's against the war.
Yeah.
We're finished.
You just lose the support of your country, forget it. And you talk about how no one knew that FDR was handicapped, you know, because it just, it was a different world back then.
We're all over the place today, by the way.
Yeah, we are so all over the place. I think it's just because I'm, whatever, it's that time. But I did have a thought I wanted to share, slightly connected to what you said. I think it's, for me, it's always been a very meaningful, it'll be a very meaningful thing. And for me, it's, I'm sorry, the phone's ringing here in the office. Yeah. So, okay, Rabbi Spiro hung up on. We could have muted that, but okay. Today is actually the 25th yard site of Nachshon Waxman. And I thought about it because you mentioned terrorist attacks, and Nachshon Waxman was, I think it was talk about the press and the terrible things you see in the press, and but then you can see every now and then the Jewish people rally in an amazing way. And I think that for those of you who remember the Nachshon Waxman situation, that was a time of Klal Yisrael really uniting around, and we've seen this time and time again, but in a very I won't say special way because it was tragic, but for those of you who don't know the story, Nachshon Waxman was an Israeli soldier who was hitchhiking home, as soldiers, I don't know if they still do, but were prone to do in those days, and he was picked up by a car with a Tanakh and a Siddur on the dashboard, and the drivers were all wearing yarmulkes and playing Jewish music. They turned out to be Hamas terrorists, and they put out a video where there's an ultimatum given that if 200 Palestinian terrorists are not released from Israeli jails, he was going to be executed Friday night, 10 p.m., I think it was. And you saw that the Waxman family, who, by the way, I think it was Mrs. Waxman was American, and Nachshon was both American and Israeli. He had dual citizenship. So they really appealed to the world. They are from people, and they appealed to the, first of all, they of course appealed to Clinton and Rabin and Muslim leaders, but they appealed to the world to daven. And they had a prayer vigil that Thursday night where over 100,000 people showed up at the Kotel from all walks of Jewish life to daven for the safe return of Nachshon. And she implored Jewish women, even if they weren't accustomed to do so, to light Shabbos candles that week. And they said that, you know, again, tens of thousands of women who didn't usually light Shabbos candles lit Shabbos candles that week. And the IDF actually captured the driver of the kidnapping car, and they interrogated him, and they found out where Nachshon was, and they planned a rescue mission. They just had one piece of botched intelligence, and that was that the door, they were told he was behind a steel door, and he's actually behind two iron doors. So in the process of the explosives and the time, they lost the element of surprise. Unfortunately, Nachshon was killed, the captain of the mission was killed, and it was not a successful mission. So that Motzei Shabbos, Nachshon's funeral happened, and his Rosh Hashiva gave the Hesped. And I just think there's a beautiful message here. It's always very important to talk about. And the Rosh Hashiva, Mordechai Alon was his name, said, in the name of Nachshon's father, he said, I'm sure you were all bothered by the same, by this very question as to Nachshon's abduction brought Klal Yisrael together in a way that we haven't seen in a long time. People were praying who usually don't pray. What happened to all those prayers? And he said, and this is the father who just lost his son 24 hours before. He said that just like a father would always like to say yes to his son, but sometimes has to say no, and the child often doesn't understand why, that's what a Kodesh Baruch Hu has done to us. We all daven and we asked what we wanted, and a Kodesh Baruch Hu said no, and we don't understand why. And that's just a powerful lesson of tefillah and our connection with the Almighty. That a lot of times we think we understand how the world runs, and we think we understand how things should be done, and we think it all makes sense. But bottom line is, just like in parenting and being a child, you know, you don't always have the full picture, and that's the bottom line. Rabbi Spear, any closing statements before you head off to Muncie for the Shalom Zachar and the Bris that I wasn't invited to?
You're always invited. And yes, you know, like I said, exciting time of the year, just all these parshas with Avram. And we all know that the reading of the Torah, we're not just reading what happened, but we're reliving it. So now is a great time for a person to develop their emunah, to develop their trust in Hashem.
Yeah,
to be like Avraham, right? The Gra says in every generation, there's a Zer Anpin, a small manifestation of Moshe Rabbeinu, of Avraham Avinu. And it's true in every person as well. So every person can tap into his Avraham Avinu and to increase their Emunah and to Mekadosh Hashem, to sanctify Hashem's name. It's a great time of the year to do so. And we should all be Zaycha.
And to all of you out there, please leave a review for this podcast. Please send us your feedback. We love to communicate with you. And we'll talk to you more next week. And in the meantime, a big old fat welcome to the guest. It's to be a